This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain, in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Deuteronomy. And now here's Pastor Sandy in Deuteronomy chapter 25 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
Just because God regulated divorce doesn't mean he ever approved of it. In fact, Malachi chapter 2, verse 16 makes it crystal clear. The Lord God of Israel says that he hates divorce. Don't ever doubt what God's attitude toward divorce is. He hates it. For it covers one's garment with violence. That's interesting. Malachi considers divorce a violent act, and indeed it is. In fact, the Hebrew word for divorce implies an amputation. The root word means a hewing off or a cutting apart. C.S. Lewis made an interesting observation about divorce. He said, "Christians all regard divorce as something like cutting up a living body, as a kind of surgical operation. Some think that the operation is so violent that it cannot be done at all. Others admit that it is a desperate remedy in extreme cases. They are all agreed that it is more like having your legs cut off than it is like dissolving a business partnership." Indeed, that's true. God hated divorce. It was a violent act. It tore apart a union between two people. And thus, this law in chapter 24 is an attempt by God to curb divorce and to promote marriage. What it did was formalize a procedure that made a divorce more difficult to obtain and therefore discouraged it. He says, "When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house." Now, prior to this law, all you had to do to divorce your wife was just say, "Bye-bye, honey." That was it. But notice what he does here. Now you have to obtain a certificate, which would force you to visit the elders of the city. This also would create a cooling off period. It would also require public exposure of your deeds. Now the person seeking the divorce has to think, well, maybe the problems can be worked out after all. Does this person really want the public humiliation of admitting to a failed marriage? Now all of a sudden he has to think through these things. Because of the time delay, rash judgments will now be avoided. Verse 2, "When she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand and sends her out of the house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as his wife, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance." See, here's a second way that this law discouraged divorce. All divorces in Israel were permanent. Divorce your spouse and you can't change your mind. Not next month, not next year, not in the next 20 years. Again, this was an attempt to discourage divorce. This was to cause you to think seriously about initiating the divorce in the first place. Several months ago, Glenn Wolf died in a Los Angeles nursing home. Glenn was 88 years old. And though he had left behind several children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, no one came to claim his body. The city of Los Angeles paid for him to be buried in an unmarked grave. But what made Glenn's case so unusual was that he was a world record holder. The Guinness Book of World Records recognized Glenn as the most married man. Glenn Wolf had been married and divorced 29 times. 29 times. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what were the women, what were the 21 and 22 and 23 gals thinking? What stuns me about this is here was a man who spent his whole life looking for love, and sought to find it by changing wives, changing situations. And yet in the end, because he didn't stick with anyone, there was no one who loved him enough to even give him a decent burial. I hope you'll consider that divorce may not be the answer after all. That if you're looking for love, it might be best found by sticking with the one you got. Working it out. Resolving your problems. Being committed. These are the seeds of love. Let me encourage you. Love the one you got. Verse 5. When a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business. He shall be free at home 1 year and bring happiness to his wife whom he has taken. A newlywed was allowed a whole year off from military duty or from any kind of civil service to focus on his marriage, to build a good foundation. I think what he's saying is that the best way to protect against divorce is to strengthen marriages. That should be our strategy as well. He says, no man shall take the lower or the upper millstone in pledge, for he takes one's living in pledge. In other words, without two millstones, you can't produce grain, you can't grind the grain, you can't feed yourself. No bread, you don't eat. And so don't take a man's livelihood as collateral. Then he can't feed himself to make the money to pay you back. If a man is found kidnapping any of his brethren of the children of Israel and mistreats him or sells him, then that kidnapper shall die, and you shall put away the evil from among you. In ancient times, people were seldom abducted and then held for ransom. Usually the captives were sold into slavery. For example, Joseph. Verse 8, take heed in an outbreak of leprosy, that you carefully observe and do according to all that the priests, the Levites, shall teach you, just as I commanded them, so you shall be careful to do. Remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam on the way when you came out of Egypt. You remember that story. Numbers chapter 12. Miriam was Moses' sister, and she rebelled against her brother's authority, and in response, God struck her with leprosy. We studied the laws concerning leprosy and Leviticus 13 and 14. He says, when you lend your brother anything, you shall not go into his house to get his pledge. You shall stand outside, and the man to whom you lend shall bring the pledge out to you. No illegal search and seizures. I mean, there were procedures for these things. And if the man is poor, you shall not keep his pledge overnight. You shall in any case return the pledge to him again when the sun goes down, that he may sleep in his own garment and bless you, and it shall be righteousness to you before the Lord your God. Don't hold a poor man's coat on a cold night as collateral when he needs it to stay warm. I mean, be kind. Have a heart, would you? Kindness to the poor is righteousness before God. Now you shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether one of your brethren or one of the aliens who is in your land within your gates. Each day you shall give him his wages and not let the sun go down on it, for he is poor and has set his heart on it, lest he cry out against you to the Lord and it be sin to you. Pay the wages promptly. Don't hold back a man's wages, especially when he's living hand to mouth, when he's living paycheck to paycheck. Pay him on time. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall the children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin. And before I had kids of my own, I might have had a hard time understanding how anyone would be willing to die for someone else, but not now, because I got four of them, and if any one of them were ever sentenced to death, I would gladly take their place. Thankfully, God says you can't do that. Well, he does. You shall not pervert justice due the stranger or the fatherless, nor take a widow's garment as a pledge. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to it. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. You see, this was how welfare was administered in Israel. After the harvest, the poor would go out and comb the fields for the leftovers. So don't go back and accumulate all the leftovers. Don't pick the bone clean. You know, give something for the poor. Give something for the oppressed. But notice here, it wasn't a handout. The poor people had to go out and they had to pick it up themselves. It wasn't just given to them. They had to go out and do something to obtain it. I think we could learn something about that in the administration of our welfare today. He says, when you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterward. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. Chapter 25. If there is a dispute between men, and they come to court, that the judges may judge them, and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, that the judge will cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence according to his guilt with a certain number of blows. Now the judge not only set the number of blows in proportion to the crime, but then he then oversaw the punishment to make sure that the sentence wasn't exceeded. Verse 3, 40 blows he may give him and no more. 40 was the limit. Lest he should exceed this and beat him with many blows above these, and your brother be humiliated in your sight and likely die, I might add. Jewish tradition says that if the executioner administered the scourging exceeded 40 lashes, then he himself received 40 lashes. That was his punishment. That was the punishment for going over the limit. And this is why, to be on the safe side, the man holding the whip always stopped at 39, just in case he had miscounted somewhere along the way. He'd stop at 39. And thus, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 24, when Paul lists the persecutions that he said suffered, he writes, from the Jews, five times I received 40 stripes minus one, the 39. Verse 4, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Again, another be kind to your animal verse. In other words, let the ox eat from the results of his labor. As he's treading out the grain, if he wants to stick his head down in a grain and grab a mouthful, let him. It's interesting. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 9, Paul takes this very verse and interprets it as a be kind to your pastor verse. He does. He says it's proper to let your pastor stick his head down in the grain and grab a mouthful to feed himself. It's proper to let your pastor enjoy the fruits of his labor. In other words, pay your pastor. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. This was a significant law in Israel. It was called the law of the Levirate. And the Hebrew word levir means brother-in-law. If a man died, his brother was to marry his bereaved sister-in-law and sire a son to bear his family name and to carry on the lineage of his dead brother. Verse 7, but if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. And if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders. This was a major insult. Remove his sandal from his foot and spit in his face. A public humiliation. and answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house, and his name shall be called in Israel the house of him who had his sandal removed. This law becomes the background of the wonderful story that we'll study later in the book of Ruth. Verse 11. If two men fight together and the wife of one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of the one attacking him and puts out her hand and seizes him by the genitals, then you shall cut off her hand and your eye shall not pity her. Whoa, Nelly. Ladies, if you help your husband in a fight, whatever you do, don't hit below the belt. Now, I think the offense here is certainly not in her defending her husband, but it's where she aims her attack. Remember back in chapter 23, verse 1? You remember that verse? An emasculated man was banned from the congregation. You see, Israel's covenant with God was tied to his lineage. And thus, any attack on a Hebrew man's ability to reproduce was considered a major offense. Today, salvation has nothing to do with lineage. Today, salvation is by faith. It's by grace through faith. Thus, if a lady today, living in this age of grace, is attacked by a man, then hitting below the belt with your foot or with your knee is exactly where you should aim. God would approve. It's just another advantage of being saved by grace, not by the law. Understand that? You agree with that interpretation? Well, maybe. Verse 13. You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy and a light. Of course, in ancient times, all the transactions were conducted by the use of scales. Gold, grain, commodities that were exchanged were all weighed. And so make sure you use an honest scale. You shall not have in your house differing measures, a large and a small. You shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure. Stick with one standard. Be fair in your business practices, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. For all who do such things and all who behave unrighteously are an abomination to the Lord your God. Verse 17. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt. How he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. You remember, as soon as they had crossed the Red Sea, the Amalekites attacked. They wanted to take advantage of this vulnerable band of slaves that had just gotten their freedom, that had not had time to be organized, had not had time to mobilize. Amalek wanted to hurt God's people when they were at their weakest and most vulnerable, and God didn't forget their ruthlessness. He says, therefore, it shall be when the Lord your God is giving you rest from your enemies all around in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. God didn't forget, and neither should Israel forget. Vengeance would come. Four centuries later, God will command King Saul to annihilate the Amalekites. And his unwillingness to do so is what will cost him his kingdom. Well, chapter 26 records the liturgy, the prayer, the praise that a worshiper should say over his or her tithe when it's offered to the Lord. You see, it wasn't just important that you gave to the Lord, but it was also important what you said along with the offering. And this is why I'm always making a big deal. I hope you've heard this. I know you've heard this before, but I wish you would take heed that just going back and just dropping your tithe in the offering box is not enough. God does approve of that. He loves that. We're grateful for that. But that's not enough. When you drop your tithe in the offering box, stop and say a prayer over that tithe. Or before you take it to the offering box, offer it up to the Lord and say a prayer over that offering. That is as important to God as the gift itself. He says in verses 1 through 4, he says, bring the tithe to the tabernacle. Summarizing a little bit here. Bring the tithe to the tabernacle, hand it to the priest. Then in verse 5, this is what you should say. And you shall answer and say before the Lord your God, my father was a Syrian about to perish. And he went down to Egypt and dwelt there, few in number. And there he became a great nation, mighty and populous. But the Egyptians mistreated us, afflicted us, and laid hard bondage on us. Then we cried out to the Lord God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and looked on our affliction and on our labor and on our oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, with great terror and with signs and wonders. He has brought us to this place and has given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which you, O Lord, have given me. In essence, they were praying, Lord, you've done so much for us. We're giving back to you a portion of the abundance that you have given us. And that is exactly what we need to say whenever we give our tithe to the Lord. Then you shall set it before the Lord your God and worship before the Lord your God. So you shall rejoice in every good thing which the Lord your God has given to you in your house, you and the Levite and the stranger who is among you. When you have finished laying aside all the tithe of your increase in the third year, the year of tithing, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your gates and be filled. Tithes were actually given every year, but in the third year, they went to support the poor, the fatherless, the widow, as well as the Levite. Verse 13 is the prayer that accompanies the tithe for the poor. And then he says, I have not eaten any of it when in mourning, nor have I removed any of it for any unclean use, nor given any of it for the dead. A practice that was common among the Canaanites and the Egyptians was to put food in with the deceased, into the grave with the deceased when you buried him. Sort of a little snack for the afterlife. And thus their giving of this grain or this snack was tainted with superstition. And I think this is a lesson for our giving. This applies to us because there are folks that I know who give to God in almost a superstitious fashion. They think that their offering is going to bind God to bless them in some specific way. It's not how you should give. When you give to God, give with no strings attached. Give because you love Him, not because you expect something out of Him. Don't let superstition taint your thanksgiving. Well, Moses closes the chapter in verses 16 through 19. This day the Lord your God commands you to observe these statutes and judgments. Therefore, you shall be careful to observe them with all your heart and with all your soul. Today you have proclaimed the Lord to be your God, and that you will walk in His ways and keep His statutes, His commandments, and His judgments, and that you will obey His voice. Also today, the Lord has proclaimed you to be His special people, just as He has promised you that you should keep all His commandments, and that He will set you high above all nations which He has made in praise, in name, and in honor, and that you may be a holy people to the Lord your God, just as He has spoken. They committed themselves to the Lord, and what did the Lord do? He committed Himself to them. Yes, we'll keep your statutes, your commandments. And God says, yes, and you will be my special people. I hope you've made that kind of commitment to the Lord. And if you have, I know that He, in turn, has made that kind of commitment to you.
That's all we have time for on this edition of Sandy Adams Radio. If you're interested in hearing today's message in the book of Deuteronomy again, or want to listen to other teachings from Pastor Sandy, go to sandyadams.org. You'll find a complete archive of his scripturally based messages, as well as a link to download our mobile app. While you're there, make sure to click on the Resources tab. This will take you to our shop. There you'll find several books for purchase to accompany your personal studies of God's Word. These are written by Pastor Sandy. Do you live in the Atlanta area, or will you be visiting? If so, we'd love to meet you in person. Come join us at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain on Sunday mornings for our time of worship, Bible study, and fellowship. Come just as you are. You'll find you're among friends here. Service time, directions, and more information can be found at sandyadams.org. You can also give us a call at 770-736-2828. That's 770-736-2828. When you call, please let us know how we can be lifting you up in prayer. Would you pray for us too? We can't do any of this without the loving guidance of our Creator. Thanks for praying for us. Pastor Sandy has more to share next time from Deuteronomy, so be sure to tune in again to Sandy Adams Radio.